people who are criminalized look like me. So if anybody's going to challenge this law, it is not a physician that looks like me. And I think that because I am 2% of the physician workforce in the United States as a Black woman, Black people need to me to stay free, and the other people that I care for who are people of color and people who speak different languages need the caring care that I provide and what I am committed to provide in the community that I serve, which is medically underserved, ethnically diverse, socioeconomically depressed, and they deserve just dignified and qualified care by a provider who looks like them, speaks their language, and cares for them in a way that makes them feel seen, heard, and well cared for. I will say that
I'm going to interrupt one second because I want to give Chris Love the last word, and we just have 30 seconds. You want to get to a million signatures. How are you going to do that at this point? What has the response been since yesterday?
Well, we've obviously had a groundswell of support from Arizona voters who are mad as hell that this has happened. So, obviously, our signature numbers are up. We'll be collecting signatures through the weekend. Our fundraising efforts are up. I think Arizona voters truly believe that our judges have gone too far and they need to have the say of that.
I want to thank you all for being with us. Chris Love of Arizona for Abortion Access, Alejandra Pablos, Arizona reproductive justice activist, and Dr. Deshaun Taylor, OBGYN physician. She is head of Desert Star Institute for Family Planning in Phoenix. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
What you're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, fighting fire with fire, how that's becoming an increasingly used strategy against wildfires in the Pacific Northwest. Fighting cybersecurity threats needs to be more of a priority, according to an Oregon senator. And those who want to be Oregon's next Secretary of State are stepping up and hoping the voters agree. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 11th, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. Northwest states are collaborating with the feds on using prescribed burns as a way to fight wildfires. Prescribed burning is the purposeful use of fire to reduce the risk from fire fuel sources in the forest. Eric Tegedoff talks to a regional administrator with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency about how this tool is used to fight increasingly devastating wildfires.
State and federal agencies are collaborating to increase the use of prescribed fires in the Northwest. Prescribed fire is the controlled use of burns to minimize the larger risks of wildfires and smoke. It's seen as an increasingly important strategy as wildfire seasons pose greater threats to the Northwest. Casey Sixkiller is the regional administrator for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Prescribed burn is one of the best tools we have for making our forests more resilient against catastrophic wildfires. And they help to manage and target hazardous fuels and make for healthier forests.
Sixkiller says the EPA is involved because wildfire smoke poses risks to people's health. The collaboration is between federal agencies, departments in Oregon and Washington, and tribal governments. Sixkiller says the collaboration needed a formal agreement to move forward.
That is what we've been able to do here with this agreement, is to get federal land managers and states and us all in the same room, making sure they're all on the same page about what success looks like.
Six Killer says the collaboration has another advantage. It helps drive engagement with communities that could be impacted by prescribed burns.
They have the confidence that the effort that's gone into planning that activity has been thought out from soup to nuts, and that they have a seat at the table and are being engaged, and their concerns are being addressed as we go forward with that activity.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The dams that people in the Northwest depend on are at risk due to cybersecurity threats. That's the message Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden had as he spoke to other senators on Capitol Hill.
Dams that generate our hydropower are no exception to the serious set of threats that we are facing in cybersecurity generally. Countries like China and Russia present a significant national security concern, as they have the ability to shut down core functions of our society and even cause death by hacking critical infrastructure. The subcommittee is being told by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which licenses 2,500 dams, that the dams responsible for well over half of the non-federal power generation have not received a cybersecurity audit. And currently, there's no plan to complete these missing audits anytime soon. FERC has told my staff, we want to thank them for their cooperation and their forthcoming way in which they've handled this. They've told my staff that they simply don't have the ability to review the remaining dams within the next decade. Big part of the challenge is FERC has just 4 cybersecurity experts to oversee 2,500 dams. Today, there are no minimum standards, no audits of a majority of dams, and bad cybersecurity. That is inviting cybersecurity trouble in the Pacific Northwest. As the chairman of the subcommittee responsible for dams, I do not want to sit around and wake up to a news report about a small town in the Pacific Northwest getting wiped out because of a cybersecurity attack against a private dam upriver. FERC cybersecurity rules only apply to dams that are remotely managed over the internet. This practice enables companies to save money, but not requiring an operator on site. But those cost savings for the dam operator lead to significantly greater cyber risks. In addition, there are no mandatory cybersecurity requirements for dams only administered by on-site operators. To make matters worse, FERC's cybersecurity rules have not been updated since 2016. They aren't specific enough and are mostly about paperwork and checking boxes. FERC doesn't have the resources it needs to be an effective regulator of the cybersecurity of private sector or run dams. This is a problem for the Congress to address. Now it's time for Congress to step up. The seriousness of cyber threats to critical infrastructure has been clear for years. Companies and agencies across the federal government have been slow to respond to the cyber threats, which are the result of a combination of factors, including weak regulation, no audits, and no accountability. Last year, I asked the Department of Homeland Security Cybersecurity Review Board to look into the theft of senior government officials' emails from Microsoft servers. DHS published the board's report last week, which documented numerous cybersecurity problems that seriously undermine U.S. national security. Microsoft software is used widely across the U.S. government and industry. And if you look at these practices, which we've seen for years now, they're undermining America's cyber defenses and creating a serious threat to national security. One of the central issues is that the United States doesn't have a more coordinated approach to cybersecurity. Cybersecurity of each part of our society is regulated in a different way, and some end up not being regulated at all. Some have rules, some have the honor system. My own view is this is not good enough. So there is no wonder that there are broad parts of our government and society with awful cybersecurity, no effective rules, and no cyber safety regulatory efforts. The Congress needs to address cybersecurity broadly rather than playing a whack-a-mole industry or agency one at a time. Unfortunately, we can't solve the biggest problem in this sub. We can accelerate updating FERC cybersecurity standards, making sure those standards are effective and apply to all dams. That will help protect the United States from a serious national security threat. I look forward to working with our witnesses and all members of the committee to deal with the scope and scale of an enormous challenge in our hydroelectric systems and others.
That's Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. It's an important job. The Oregon Secretary of State is second in line to be governor and is also in charge of elections and audits for the state. Six candidates, four Democrats and two Republicans, recently took part in a City Club candidate forum to show what they'd offer voters. First, here's Democrat James Crary.
In 2022, just under 67% of registered voters voted in Oregon. In 2004, it was just under 86.5%. So why the huge drop in voter participation? To me, it's because people don't feel like their vote means anything. And what I want to do is, when I am elected, on the Secretary of State's website, I'll add a new tab. I'm going to call it the Electronic Candidate Form. And what that's going to do is allow any registered voter to ask questions of any or all of the candidates and then easily compare and contrast the different answers. This is going to engage, empower, and educate voters, especially young voters, because young voters are tied to their smartphones. It's just a way of life. And any smartphone, any tablet, any desktop you have, you can ask a question of any or all of the candidates. People that are running for office are applying for a job. And every job that I've ever applied for, you had to go through an interview.
Democrat Tobias Reed.
Thanks to the City Clubs for this opportunity. I'm running for Secretary of State because it is a really important job with important responsibilities. That is always true, but it's especially true right now when so much of what we care about and count on for our system of government is at risk. We should not make the mistake of thinking that the wonderful way we do elections in Oregon with mail-in ballots and automatic voter registration are invulnerable. There are people who are trying to roll that back, who are threatening violence and intimidation. So the Secretary of State needs to be in a strong position to defend those. In addition, the Secretary of State is the auditor. We need an audit process that is driven not by politics, but by a realistic and rigorous assessment of risk. Those are the things that I will bring to the office. I also want to bring my experience as a statewide elected official, running an agency, setting a mission, and ensuring accountability. There's no substitute for that experience in Oregon running a statewide agency. That's why I've got the endorsement of the three former Secretaries of State who have endorsed in this race.
Democrat James Manning.
My name is James Ivory Manning, Jr. I am a public servant running to restore the trust and integrity of the Office of Secretary of State. I will defend democracy, preserve vote by mail, and ensure our election workers and protected our Oregon data is secure. As a former United States Army Assistant Inspector General, I will use the power of the audit to ensure that transparency, accountability of all of our department agencies and state-run programs. As a member of the state land boards, Oregonians can count on me to ensure that our public lands, waterways, and state forests are not for sale. That's why I've earned exclusive endorsement of Congressman Peter DeFazio and the Sierra Club and 350 Salem, Oregon. My commitment to preserve our precious natural resources for our future generation is unwavering.
Democrat David Stoffer.
The Secretary of State is also the chair of the Board of Sustainability and Environment, CORS 184.421 at SWEEC. I am the best person to fulfill this role because I have five practical, workable, affordable, profit-making, politically correct, patented inventions that can greatly improve Oregon's environment. One of my inventions can heat your house and air condition your house or building and heat your water so that you can have hot running water, all without burning fossil fuels that pollute the air. If thousands of houses and buildings quit polluting the air, we would have fewer environmental problems with global warming, breathing illnesses, and air pollution. I have another patented invention that can generate electricity from pollution-free and inexpensive wind power, and another to generate electricity by pollution-free and inexpensive wave power. You may find these environmental solutions spelled out in the videos on the Facebook site of Dave Stoffer for Secretary of State.
Republican Dennis Linthicum.
Thank you for inviting us here today. It's great to have an opportunity to speak to these constituents. And I am currently a state senator for District 28, which includes a major portion of Central Oregon, Southern Deschutes County, Eastern Jackson County, and all of Klamath County. Before the last redistricting effort, Lake County and all of Cook County were also included in my Senate district. I have a background as a trained economist and being a former senior vice president for management information systems. I've also actually been a construction contractor board license holder and am currently a rancher engaged in land management and sustainability issues. I bring a wealth of technical and managerial expertise to the table, and my expensive expertise in these positions, I think, will be provide a great opportunity for me to unlock the potential of individuals within the Secretary of State's office and seize on opportunities to achieve positive outcomes for all Oregonians.
Republican Tim McLeod.
Currently, I work in business development and information management systems. However, I have experience across the gambit from governmental to nonprofit to large and small business, which does include small business ownership. I've had an opportunity to engage the sphere of economy here in Oregon. My education background is in small city management and public administration with a minor in business administration. However, my expertise continues far beyond the source of my institutional education. So as a result, I am involved currently as the chair of the Republican Elections Committee. I have had numerous opportunities to engage at the highest state level of executive leadership and operations. And I do see this as a role that needs somebody with an experience in innovation, somebody with the ability to communicate through conflict, and somebody who is resilient and able to stand in and manage the difficult challenges to come.
And those are the candidates on the ballot in May's primary election for Oregon's Secretary of State. A majority of women veterans are not enrolled in VA healthcare, yet these women have experienced a more than 60% increase in suicide rates over the past two decades. An estimated 1 in 3 women veterans have experienced sexual trauma while serving, including violent sexual assaults. Catherine Carley reports.
Executive Director of the Augusta-based Sisters in Arms Center, Rebecca Cornell DeHoo, says lawmakers have a chance to help veteran survivors rebuild their lives.
To have a consistent clinician there to provide that trauma treatment to the women veterans in a place that they're safe, I think can really support their recovery.
Cornell DeHoo says 1 in 3 women soldiers experience some form of sexual trauma while in the military, but many incidents go unreported. There are more than 10,000 women veterans currently living in Maine. Women veterans are one of the fastest growing sectors of the homeless population and are 4 times more likely to become homeless than their male peers. Researchers also now identify military sexual trauma as the biggest factor driving a more than 60% increase in suicide rates among women veterans since 2001. Cornell DeHoo says while group therapy is available to these veterans, state funding would provide for more formalized treatment, especially for those coming off active duty.
I think if people knew the stories of what had happened to these women while they're in the service, just really disheartening stories of assault, I think that they wouldn't hesitate to fund a position so that they can get help.
Cornell DeHoo says sexual trauma is most prevalent among lower-ranking 17 and 18-year-olds who are influenced to think that reporting an incident is a betrayal of a fellow soldier. She says it's important to support those who have come forward to advocate for themselves and others and who took an oath to serve their country. I'm Catherine Carley.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Murtaugh. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, it'll be cloudy with an overnight low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow, the clouds continue, a high of 64. Today in history, in 1968 on this date, President Lyndon B. Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act of 1968, prohibiting discrimination in the sale, rental, and financing of housing. Our quote of the day is from American writer Kurt Vonnegut, who died this day in 2007. He wrote in Timequake, quote, "Many people need desperately to receive the message. I feel and think much as you do, care about many of the things you care about. Although most people don't care about them, you are not alone." Montana's Alliance for the Wild Rockies has joined other conservation groups. They're suing the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for refusing to protect wolves under the Endangered Species Act. Mark Moran has the story.
A coalition of conservation groups has sued the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for refusing to relist wolves under the Endangered Species Act. Helena-based Alliance for the Wild Rockies is part of the suit. The alliance sued to successfully overturn the wolf's delisting in 2012, but that move fell victim to congressional funding bill negotiations. Alliance Executive Director Mike Garrity says the wolves clearly qualify to be protected under the act and that hunting is driving down their numbers and could cause problems for the animals.
As their numbers decline, they're at greater risk for inbreeding. And once inbreeding sets in, then the population is sunk.
Livestock and cattle owners argue that wolves are a threat to their flocks and herds and want their numbers reduced. The suit was filed in federal district court in Missoula. Beyond keeping a robust population of wolves on Montana's lands and helping their species thrive, Garrity argues wolves can also help reduce the population of diseased animals.
We're starting to have disease in deer, such as chronic wasting disease. Predators like wolves are really good at focusing on the sick animals. That's an excellent way to control chronic wasting disease.
Garrity says wolf management policies in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, all of which allow aggressive hunting of the animals, fail to protect wolves and all native species for future generations, the primary mandate of the Endangered Species Act. This is Mark Moran.
Hamas says it does not have the 40 Israeli hostages needed for a possible ceasefire. Arizona Republicans squashed Democrats' attempt to repeal the near-total abortion ban, and House GOP tensions intensify over a surveillance law. For more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
Many families have mourned the loss of loved ones, while others still live with the uncertainty of knowing their family members are held in captivity.
Republican Indiana Congressman Jim Baird speaking about families of Israelis held in Gaza. Hamas now says it can't meet the demand to release 40 hostages to start the first phase of a ceasefire. Observers have questioned how many of the estimated 130 hostages might be held by other groups or may already be dead, but the announcement comes as a surprise. An Israeli airstrike that killed sons and grandchildren of a top Hamas leader is also making ceasefire negotiations difficult. House Speaker Mike Johnson is facing his own difficulties. Former President Donald Trump encouraged House conservatives to shoot down an update to a controversial surveillance law. Trump claims falsely that FISA was used to spy on his campaign. Johnson says the current legislation would have put in warrant protections for people inside the U.S.
But these reforms would actually kill the abuses that allowed President Trump's campaign to be spied on. And there are massive new, for example, criminal and civil penalties for using opposition research.
Former Trump Attorney General Bill Barr condemned his old boss's call to kill FISA and said there will be blood on people's hands if the intelligence tools expire. But Johnson's right flank is already unhappy. After the speaker needed help from Democrats to pass a $1.2 trillion spending package and avoid a government shutdown, right-wing Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene threatened to remove him.
How he handles the FISA process and how he handles funding Ukraine is going to tell our entire conference how to handle the motion to vacate.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says they'll soon take up Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas' impeachment. Republicans say Mayorkas should be removed for failing to enforce immigration law, but Democrats, including Schumer, describe the impeachment as political and baseless.
The Senate is ready to go whenever the House is. We want to address this issue as expeditiously as possible. And as I said yesterday, impeachment should never be used to settle policy disagreements.
Following the Arizona Supreme Court upholding a 160-year-old ban on nearly all abortions, Democrats tried but failed to repeal it in the Republican-run legislature. Democratic Senate candidate Congressman Ruben Gallego points to an abortion referendum headed for the ballot, as when voters will get their say.
And we're going to fight all the way until November so we can get
abortion rights back for our women in Arizona.
President Joe Biden is condemning the court's decision, putting back in place a law actually passed when Arizona was still a territory.
Elect me. I'm in the 21st century, not back then. They weren't even a state.
Trump was in Georgia Wednesday and said he would not sign a national abortion ban if reelected. He criticized the Arizona law for going too far. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
People debate regional policies at the Arctic Encounter Symposium in Alaska. And a sugar bush educator keeps teaching in Michigan. For these stories and much more, here's today's edition of National Native News.
Dignitaries, high-ranking military officials, and indigenous leaders from across the Arctic are in Anchorage, Alaska this week. As KYUK's Emily Schwing reports, they're here for the Arctic Encounter Symposium, the largest annual Arctic policy focus gathering in the United States.
Pearl Brower is the president and CEO of the Ukpiagvik Inupiat Corporation, UIC. She says that people who live every day in the Arctic should be the focus beyond this week's discussions.
When you're thinking about the Arctic while you're here, think about us, think about the people. And that's, I think, really the critical key component of that. As policymakers, as people working within this region, as people thinking about the Arctic, we think about the people first because that's what it's all about.
Brower, who's from Utqiagvik, was among six indigenous leaders from across the state who took to the main stage at Anchorage's Denaina Civic and Convention Center to kick off this year's symposium with a conversation about their visions for success into the future. Roy Algoin grew up in White Mountain. He was recently named the president and CEO of the First Alaskans Institute, a policy and advocacy nonprofit organization that also focuses on building leadership skills among Alaska Native youth. He says any future success must include younger generations.
I look at our youth as the starting point of new discussion, of change, of functionality, of being capable to move forward with all of the things that we need in our community.
Among the long list of topics on the Arctic Encounter agenda this week are discussions on sustainable energy, infrastructure investment, and emergency preparedness in the Arctic. I'm Emily Schwing.
The Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians is among tribes in Michigan not tapping their maple trees this spring after an unusually mild winter. Despite that, the band was able to continue with parts of the tradition at their sugar shack using maple sap that had been saved or traded for. Interlochen Public Radio's Ellie Katz spoke with Tara John, who works on restoring traditional foodways.
Tara John pulls out a few bottles of maple syrup harvested nearby that she was able to trade for. She pours the liquid into a cast iron pot over the fire and starts stirring.
I'm boiling it down. I'm going to sugar this.
After several hours of careful stirring, the syrup will thicken, eventually reducing down to a granular golden brown sugar. John has led a few sugarbush workshops like this one to teach tribal and non-tribal community members about the tradition. And the band's agriculture department says they're aiming to tap 600 trees next year, up from around 300 last year. They've invested in new equipment and home tree tapping kits to give out to families, thanks in part to a big grant aimed at reinvigorating tribal food traditions. Later in the afternoon, the sun comes out, and more people have joined around the fire. John says this, showing up to Sugarbush with intention. Being outside the sugar shack and near the Inanatiguk, the sugar maples, is vital during this year of rest for the people and the trees.
This is what I'm intending for them. And to occupy this space throughout the year to host workshops or harvesting or teachings, storytellings right here so that we can live life with these guys. They miss our laughter and our arguing and our kids running around. And they're supposed to be part of our lives. And we're coming back. We'll learn how.
That was Ellie Katz, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Spring is here and birds are chirping, but can you solve this puzzle? For that, we go to Pearl Star from KPOV Bend with the Point Puzzle, a weekly radio puzzle challenging listeners with word and logic puzzles.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to send me three words for baby animals. If you change an L to a T, you will have exactly two of each letter used. The answer is colt foal, and calf. Our winner this week is Sam Bowman, who listens to KBOO in Portland, Oregon.
Alligator, hedgehog, anteater bear, rattlesnake, buffalo, anaconda hare, bullfrog, woodchuck, wolverine, goose, whippoorwill, chipmunk, jackal, moose, mud turtle, whale, glowworm, bat, salamander, snail, and a Maltese cat, black squirrel, coon, opossum, wren, red squirrel.
For the new puzzle, I'm looking for a word that is a type of bird, but is also the sound of a different bird. So again, send me a type of bird that is also the word for the sound a different bird makes. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Flying birds. Excellent birds. Watch them fly.
There they go.
Snow. Excellent snow. Here it comes.
Watch it fall.
Long words.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of April 8th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KPOV News for Thursday, April 11th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings, Eric Tegadoff, Mark Moran, and Catherine Carley. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.